Hello and welcome to the Annals of Internal Medicine, October 7th, 2025 podcast. I'm Dr. Christine Lane, Annals Editor-in-Chief, and I'm looking forward to telling you a bit about the new articles you can find on annals.org. Private equity acquisition of hospitals is a frequent topic in the U.S. news. The next article reports a study that examined hospital staffing and patient outcomes after private equity acquisition, focusing on emergency departments and intensive care units. Researchers analyzed hospital cost report data collated by the RAND Corporation between 2007 and 2019 and 100% Medicare fee-for-service Part A and Part B claims between 2009 and 2019 from hospitals acquired by private equity firms between 2010 and 2017 who were matched to control hospitals not acquired by private equity. Primary staffing-related outcomes were salary expenditures per bed day for both the emergency department and the ICU. Secondary outcomes included total hospital salary expenditures and full-time equivalent employees. Primary clinical outcomes were ED and ICU mortality, ED and ICU transfers to another acute care hospital, and ICU length of stay. Compared to matched non-acquired hospitals, private equity hospitals reduced their ED and ICU salary expenditures by 18.2% and 15.9% following acquisition. Private equity hospitals reduced their average full-time employees, whereas control hospitals increased their average full-time employees. In-hospital mortality among those treated in the ED increased by 13.4% at private equity hospitals, while decreasing at control hospitals. At private equity hospitals, ED and ICU transfers to acute care hospitals increased by 4.2% and 10.2% from baseline, respectively. ICU length of stay decreased by 4.7%. These findings suggest reductions in salary expenditures could represent a key mechanism by which cost-cutting after private equity acquisition contributes to unfavorable changes in patient outcomes. Providing care to family members with terminal illness is extremely challenging. To see if an intervention provided via a WeChat app could help, researchers from the Fudan University in Shanghai, China, randomly assigned 147 patient-caregiver pairs to palliative care with or without access to the app. After 2 months, quality of life improved in the intervention group and decreased in the comparison group. The article includes interesting data about the app features that caregivers access most often, which may help to identify the aspects of care that interventions to assist family caregiving for terminally ill people should focus on. In 1983, in response to a mass shooting, New Zealand introduced strict firearm regulation, and there have been many subsequent changes in an effort to further reduce firearm-associated death and injury. A new article reports the results of a study that examined trends in individual and population-level risk for firearm-related offenses, hospitalizations, and death in New Zealand. The study found that firearm-related deaths decreased between 2000 and 2018. However, Maori people, young men, and rural dwellers were at higher risk than other groups. These observations underscore the importance of regulation in reducing firearm-related harm. A brief research report found that the incidence of a specific antibiotic-resistant bacteria increased 69% between 2019 and 2023. The report describes trends in incidence of carbamazepine-producing enterobacteria clinical isolates reported to the Antimicrobial Resistance Laboratory Network of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention during the time frame. The findings showed that in 29 states with mandated isolate reporting, incident of resistant cultures surged between 2019 and 2023, with the type of resistance varying at the local level. The authors note the importance of understanding local epidemiology to ensure that patients with resistant infections receive timely, appropriate care. Point-of-care ultrasound has become a ubiquitous tool in internal medicine, but there is substantial variation in how internal medicine residency programs incorporate point-of-care ultrasound learning. A new article describes the development of a curriculum for internal medicine programs that others may find useful and may help move towards a more standardized training regimen in the use of this clinical tool. Next is a prospective cohort study that found that an artificial intelligence tool was accurate and feasible for enabling opportunistic assessment of body composition from routine MRI, helping to identify patients at high cardiometabolic risk. Researchers studied data from 33,539 participants in the UK Biobank who had no history of diabetes, myocardial infarction, or ischemic stroke, and underwent a whole-body MRI. The researchers used an open-source AI model to estimate 3D body composition volumes, including subcutaneous adipose tissue, visceral adipose tissue, skeletal muscle volume, and skeletal muscle fat fraction percent from the whole-body MRI. Primary outcomes were incident diabetes and adverse cardiac events. The study found that over a median follow-up of 4.8 years, 1.2% of female and 2.5% of male participants were diagnosed with incident diabetes, and 1% and 2.4% were diagnosed with adverse cardiovascular events, respectively. When adjusting for age, smoking, and hypertension, greater adiposity measures and low skeletal muscle proportion were associated with higher incidence of both outcomes in both sexes. Overall, the AI tool accurately extracted 3D body composition values from the whole body MRI in less than 3 minutes per scan and demonstrated that as both sexes age, adipose tissue compartments and skeletal muscle fat fraction increase while skeletal muscle mass decreases. These results corroborate evidence that visceral adipose tissue, but not subcutaneous adipose tissue, is a key driver of adiposity-related cardiometabolic risk. A brief research report that used secret shopper methodology suggests that patients weighing more than 450 pounds face challenges when seeking access to subspecialty care. Of the 300 practices included in the study sample, over half lacked basic standards of care for the hypothetical patient, and 41% declined to schedule an appointment. Only 117 practices were fully accessible, with endocrinology practices being the most willing to schedule and most likely to meet basic standards of care. Additionally, many staff members made potentially insensitive weight-related comments, highlighting a clear need for both better accommodations for patients at higher weight and staff training on inclusive care. Next is a cross-sectional study that examined dispensing of gabapentin from retail pharmacies in the United States from 2010 to 2024. The findings reveal a slow but increasing rate of gabapentin prescribing over this time period, with gabapentin becoming the fifth most prescribed medication in 2024 compared with the 10th most prescribed in 2017. Substantial increases in prescribing were observed among nurse practitioners and physicians' assistants, which could reflect expanded prescribing authorities in certain states but warrants further study. The researchers note that prescribing physicians and advanced care practitioners should be alert to the potential adverse effects of gabapentin. The U.S. faces a predicted shortage of over 36,000 physicians by 2036, with an increasing proportion of physicians leaving clinical practice or expressing an intent to do so. The next article reports a study that sought to characterize rates of physician attrition from clinical practice. Researchers studied over 700,000 physicians who provided care to Medicare patients between 2013 and 2022. Unadjusted rates of clinical practice attrition increased significantly from 3.5% in 2013 to 4.9% in 2019. In adjusted models, female physicians and those practicing in rural areas were more likely to exhibit clinical practice attrition. Caring for Medicare beneficiaries with greater average risk scores, a greater average age, and a greater percent of dual eligible beneficiaries was also associated with attrition. Over recent years, there's been concern about the decline in physician scientists in the U.S. Declining National Institutes of Health funding to physicians raises questions about the physician's future in biomedical research. NIH F32 grants fund research for medical trainees as principal investigators by providing up to 3 years of salary support to develop skills for independent research. The next step in NIH funding after an F32 is a mentor developmental grant known as a K award. A new brief report examines F32 funding to internal medicine trainees and subsequent conversion to K awards across the 30-year history of F32 funding. Between 1989 and 2021, 735 F32s were awarded to internal medicine trainees. Pulmonary critical care medicine trainees received the most F32s, followed by cardiology and then nephrology. Of the 735 F32 awardees, 35.6% received K awards, totaling over $168 million in funding and over 3,000 unique publications. This report quantifies how F-32 grants to internal medicine trainees have supported the development of physician scientists over the past three decades. To what extent these grants contribute to the future career success of these trainees warrants further study. When using the GRADE instrument to evaluate evidence, users make judgments about the size of intervention effects on desirable and undesirable outcomes. Benchmarking the size of effects by using decision thresholds should facilitate these judgments and the process. Another new article provides GRADE guidance for using decision thresholds for judgments about the magnitude of desirable and undesirable health effects, for example, in clinical guidelines or health technology assessments. Also new is an ideas and opinions commentary that discusses how the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has determined levels of payment for physician services and offers recommendations for improvement in this process. A History of Medicine article analyzed over 2,000 historical birth records from Lausanne Maternity Hospital to estimate whether in utero exposure to maternal influenza-like illness during the 1918 influenza pandemic was associated with pregnancy outcomes and found that associations varied depending on the trimester of illness and fetal sex. There was strong evidence that third trimester exposure was associated with worse adverse pregnancy outcomes, including low birth weight, preterm birth, and stillbirth. Outcomes seemed to be worse when the fetus was male. And the final article I'll mention continues on the topic of pandemics, a commentary by Dr. Darrellyn Moyer, CEO of the American College of Physicians, and Dr. Jason Goldman, ACP's current president, argues that the politicization of science, which includes the evisceration of public health infrastructure and funding, diminished access to care, and the proliferation of vaccine mis- and disinformation, has created a storm that the U.S. healthcare system will be ill-prepared to weather if and when we face another pandemic. The authors say it is imperative to address these issues before a health disaster strikes, and calls on physicians to work together with local, state, and federal officials to ensure that every person receives care in a system with appropriate capacity and resources. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll go to annals.org to take a closer look at some of the new material I've highlighted. Thanks to Beth Jenkinson, Andrew Langman, and Bernie Turner for their technical support.